Welcome to the Dietitian Rehab Podcast, where we not only challenge and inspire dietitians to think outside the traditional dogmatic education, training, and attitudes for a mind wide open, but also to challenge anyone to think differently about their own health. We'll talk all things food, health, and nutrition related as we explore points of view, evidence, and strategies for better health that will allow you a fuller understanding of the hot topics that everybody's talking and asking about. Hey everyone, welcome to today's show. I'm your host, Doug Cook. And today I'll be speaking with Michelle Payne, who is one of North America's leading experts in helping the public bridge the gap between the farm and our food supply. She connects the people and science of food and farming as the founder of Cause Matters Core. She's known for being a community catalyst, a passionate advocate for global agriculture, and interestingly, antagonizing people into action. Michelle has worked with farmers in more than 25 countries and helped to raise more than $25 million for this cause. She is the author of three books, Food Bullying, a number one bestseller and IPPI Gold medalist, Food Truths, From Farm to Table, also an IPPI Award winner, a bronze medal winner for that one, and No More Food Fights. She also hosts the Food Bullying podcast. She resides with her self-described city slicker husband and cow-loving daughter on a small farm in central Indiana. So let's get to the show.
Welcome to the show, Michelle.
Thanks for having me.
I'm really looking forward to this talk because your website, as people will learn, has so much to offer in the way of just getting back down to the basics where food, food system, food production is concerned. And I never remember where I find people because social media is just like, it's, you know, it's like this rabbit hole where you just follow one person, connect with this person, connect with this person. And I stumbled upon your Instagram and your Twitter. So I just think you have a lot of great stuff to offer people. So just before we get into all that, maybe you could just tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, your journey, and to where you are today as one of North America's leading experts in connecting the farm with food, because people forget about that.
Yes, unfortunately they do. And I am a lifelong farm girl. I grew up on a farm in southern Michigan, went to Michigan State University, and have 2 degrees from Michigan State. I always have to tell people, go green. I'm an avid of Spartan, and probably of more interest, I am a mom, I am a wife, I am a stepmom, I'm an avid outdoor enthusiast, and also enjoy cycling and spinning with my husband, and really have worked for the last nearly 20 years, believe it or not, in connecting farm and food as a professional speaker and an author through my company, Cause Matters Corporation.
And your degrees are in agricultural communication, correct?
Yes, one's in agricultural communications and the other is in animal science with a dairy emphasis, which gives a nod to the beautiful black and white cows that I have roaming my front yard.
Nice. They make great lawn pets, I guess.
Well, they're behind a fence and they are grazing in a pasture. But yes, they are wonderful recyclers for sure.
So speaking of Cause Matters, you founded it, which you describe from your website as a company designed to create connections around the food plate. What does that mean exactly? And what's the focus?
So what that essentially means is that I work with the agriculture business and farmers and ranchers across the world to better communicate with people like you in the dietetic world and the nutrition world and the health world. And I also, a parallel to that, work with dietitians and health and wellness professionals in understanding where their food comes from. Because really what my assertion is that food should be about celebration, not condemnation. And so much of that comes from understanding where your food comes from, and then also understanding concerns all around the food plate about how people are feeling around their food, which unfortunately today in a pandemic, I'm a bit concerned that people do not feel that great about their food.
Oh, that's interesting. So why is that, do you think, with specifically with COVID?
Well, in my last book, Food Bullying, one of the clear points that I came up to was that when people are living in fear and they're not trusting a situation, that they're easily targeted by bullies. And clearly, as a registered dietitian, you know, and most of your listeners know, that there is no food to cure COVID. There is no food to prevent disease. There certainly are better ways of eating, and there's proactive management through nutrition and so forth. But I think because there is so much fear and uncertainty out there, it leaves people susceptible to the great deal of misinformation that's out around food. And it's just a little crazy, right? I mean, we're all living in an environment that we didn't expect to live in. And I think that if anyone was honest, they would say that their stress levels are quite high.
Yeah, gotcha. So this is a perfect example of a much larger problem as it relates to eating in general and misinformation and all that kind of stuff and guilt. So I get your point there. So I think what makes great sense for the purposes of this talk, and I will encourage everybody to get your three books. You're the author of three books. And I think what we'll do is just kind of go through the takeaways of the three books, because I think they are just framed perfectly to address all the stuff that you talked about in your intro. So the names of the books are Food Truth, From Farm to Table, 25 Ways to Shop and Eat Without Guilt, which sounds amazing. No More Food Fights, Growing a Productive Farm and Food Conversation, because as we know, things are so polarized and there's a lot of misinformation around agriculture and GMOs and who knows what. And then the last one is interesting to me because I've probably been susceptible to this as a person. And I'm almost afraid to admit that I think some of my communications might have come out as bullying, food bullying, how to avoid BS. Buying BS, as you say, is bully speak. So the first one, Food Truths from Farm to Table, you have a great quote. It says, food is at the center of so many traditions. Food's essential to our bodies. Food deserves to be celebrated, enjoyed, and shared. And the same can be true about the truth in food. So what does that mean when you came up with that amazing quote?
Well, the truth in food, in my opinion and my research, comes from the people who raise it. The truth in food comes from how it was raised and the science in how it was raised, rather than the emotions and how it's marketed. So Food Truths from Farm to Table basically addresses the 25 biggest issues at the time the book was published, most of which are still true today. It ranges from sustainability to food waste to GMOs to antibiotics, hormones, and animal welfare, all the light topics, right? Conversation. And I actually interviewed 55 different contributors in that book, ranging from farmers to ranchers to veterinarians to doctors to dietitians, to get perspective. And what I tried to do from that is lift the veil of the secrecy on farms that people seem to think is there and highlight the truth and why farmers use the practices that we do in raising food, as well as some of the truths around chemicals and GMOs and hormones and so forth. So the point of the book is that food is food. It doesn't need to be scary. It doesn't need to be riddled with half-truths and mistruths, but it should certainly be clear about what the truth in food is, and that truth comes from the people that are raising it.
So in the beginning, you mentioned you've certainly spoken at events around the world, et cetera. And no doubt you probably have some connections here in Canada.
Yes.
I don't know if you've heard of the initiative Farm and Food Care, probably the same type of thing.
I have. They're a great organization.
Yeah.
I've actually done some work with them.
Yeah, so they were great because they've done a couple of tours for dietitians. So we've gone to dairy farms, we've gone to poultry farms and seen some agriculture and that kind of thing. And so it's a huge learning opportunity because, as you've mentioned, there is a lot of misunderstanding and confusion and for sure a real gap between where our food comes and what shows up in the grocery store. So what do you think are some of the top untruths or misinformation about our food supply, food production, or agriculture?
Well, one of my favorite food truths is that genes are the most amazing ingredient on your plate. And it basically addresses some of the concerns around bioengineering. But the reason why I like it is because I'm a Holstein breeder, those black and white cows that they talked about. And it's really cool the things that we can do with genes. We can select for higher protein milk. We can select for more fertile animals. We can select for higher milk production and specific conformation characteristics. So if you breed dogs, if you have cats, you probably can relate it a little bit to there. But it seems to become a bit more scary when we're talking about our food specifically. And some studies have shown, specifically by Dr. Jason Lusk, who was at Oklahoma State at the time and is now at Purdue University, those studies have actually shown that nearly 3/4 of the American population, and having spent some time in Canada, I would say that you're probably around the same, but nearly 3/4 of the population believe that food should be labeled if it has DNA in it. That's a bit of a concern to me. And I say that a bit tongue-in-cheek, but the reality is that genetics are a part of our food, and they're an amazing part of our food. But because people don't understand them, it's difficult to explain the precision in which bioengineering is done. So that's one of the food truths that I addressed. Another one that is a personal favorite of mine as a Holstein breeder, again, is that animal welfare is an hourly concern on farms and ranches. And you can find terrible documentaries filled with drama about how farmers abuse their animals. You can find animal rights organizations that have posted all sorts of nasty videos. But for every one of those, I can find 100 farmers who will show you how they've been out there in the mud and the muck and the drought and the sunshine and the high temperatures and the winter winds caring for their animals. And so this is a real area of challenge for us in agriculture, because clearly practices on the farm are not always pretty. We need to do a better job. We, being those of us on farms and ranchers, must do a better job explaining why we do what we do. For example, dehorning. We do dehorn our cattle, and it is an ugly process. But the reason why we do that is because animals are cruel to each other, and they will hurt each other with their horns. And more importantly to me as a mom, they will hurt my daughter. I mean, those are her animals, and she's actually had a cracked finger because a heifer didn't get dehorned when she should have, and she smashed her hand. So that's another example. And then one that I think will relate to all of your listeners is around food waste, and that the answer to food waste is in your refrigerator. 40% of food in the United States is thrown out. I don't know how you compare that to Canada, but the reality is it's a huge number on both sides of the border.
Yeah.
So food waste, the answer to food waste has to be in our own kitchens. It's not in restaurants. It's not on the farm. But it's in our own kitchen, because that's what we can directly control. And the statistics are fairly staggering about where the majority of food waste happens. I do think that's improved since COVID has set in, but it is still a real issue. So those are just a few of the examples. I don't want to go on too long about it, but what I did in writing Food Truths from Farm to Table was basically offered up a story from the particular truth that I was talking about to offer that firsthand perspective, and then couched it with evidence-based or science that really illustrated the facts behind the story.
Yeah, and I think I will be curious to see what all 25 are for myself, but I know some of the hot topics, which you already know about, but I certainly am always butting up against, is the concepts of GMO, is animal welfare, and hormones and pesticides. Is it too much to talk about sustainability?
No, sustainability is actually one of the food truths. The food truth is that sustainability is complex and essential to family business. So, Doug, I guess I would turn it back to you. How do you define sustainability?
Yeah, so when I think about sustainability, I'm going to butcher this, but it really is just having a food supply that manages resources adequately and allows people to eat nutritiously, an equal distribution of nutrients and energy, which is really doesn't really say much. But I guess I think the biggest thing, I'm convinced that there's nothing wrong with raising cows and livestock and that type of stuff. And I know there's a lot of misinformation about greenhouse gases, et cetera. And I don't know if it's too much to go into, or like, what I'm fascinated by is this concept of regenerative agriculture, because I know people do not have an understanding of how soil is made, what role grazing animals have on the plains, like they did, you know, when there was bison and that kind of stuff, what role agricultural animals have and what the real impact is on the environment in terms of methane and that kind of stuff. Because the arguments are really black and white. It's like, there's no way we can raise animals, foods, animal-based products to satisfy the planet. We have to go with monocultures like, you know, soybeans and wheat and rice and all the problems that go with that. So I'm just wondering if it's too much to go into for this interview, I'm just wondering if there's a way to kind of summarize in a little bit, like kind of that life cycle of methane and carbon and what role animals play. Because of course, people think if you just get rid of the animals, everything's going to be better.
Yeah, it's an interesting misnomer, but I think we have to back up first a little bit and look at sustainability, because sustainability and sustainable food is one of those claims that really has no definition out there. It's not definable, therefore it's not truly distinguishable when it comes to a specific food label. But when you look at sustainability overall, my definition is that it has to include not only the environmental benefits, but also the business benefits for family businesses. So clearly in a time where we have small businesses struggling, I think that most people can relate that having a sustainable small business requires support of the community and requires people to believe in their practices. I would put family farms and ranches into that bucket. And that's the majority of Canadian agriculture for sure. Mm-hmm. And so part of that sustainability has to be economically viable. It has to have a marketplace that supports it and understands that they are supporting a sustainable business, not only environmentally, but fiscally. So that's not nearly as exciting as hearing is that cows are polluting the environment and that cows are responsible. And I lovingly say cow farts. It is technically burps. Clearly, yeah. It comes from the other end, but cow farts, you know, just has a little bit more sex appeal to it. So anyhow, what you need to know, bottom line, is that cows are not poisoning the environment. And cows, while they do contribute to the greenhouse gas problem, what you do as a human being actually contributes substantially more. Perfect example of that is right now, first time in our lifetime where we have fewer airplanes flying, less manufacture happening, and we have the cleanest air that we have had in decades. Clearly, from every picture you see around the world, that is irrefutable. But it's interesting when you look at the statistics of sustainability and greenhouse gas emissions. When you look at the generation of electricity, which clearly we all benefit from, myself included, that generation of electricity actually makes for 7 times more greenhouse gas emissions than the methane of all of the livestock in our country, in the United States, according to EPA. Similar statistics in Canada again. And the reality is that when you look at transportation, it also generates 7 times more greenhouse gas emissions than the methane from livestock, than those cow burps and those cow farts. Mm-hmm. And so we have to take some responsibility. Can agriculture do better? Certainly. Are we trying? Yes, we are. I could bore you with all sorts of statistics, but when you look at the population of livestock, it's actually declined 11%. And the production of meat has actually more than doubled during that time frame since 1961. So statistically, I can tell you all the stories, but here's what I would like you to remember about regenerative agriculture. Soil is the greatest asset of any farmer, whether you have crops or whether you have animals. And here's why. Because my cattle, as an example, are out on pasture. They are depending on that grass to feed them from May until about October. I live in Indiana, so we have a bit of a longer season than most of you up north. And if the soil is not healthy, the grass isn't healthy, and therefore the cattle aren't healthy. So soil is critically important to all of us. And if we destroy the soil, it clearly takes decades to come back. But what's really cool as far as this whole concept of regenerative agriculture is that 70% of all land globally, So whether it's in China, whether it's in Canada, or whether it's in Cambodia, 70% of all agricultural land globally is rangeland, and it can only be utilized as grazing land for ruminants. So for example, a pig isn't a ruminant, but cattle are, dairy cattle, beef cattle, sheep, and the like. So they can utilize this rangeland, otherwise the land would not be used. And so regenerative agriculture has been going on for a lifetime. It just has a fancy new name. And do we need to be paying attention to the soil and the greenhouse gases and carbon footprints? Yes, we do. But I think we need to give credit where credit's due. And that's the fact that cattle are amazing recyclers, regardless of what the latest vegan campaign tells you or the latest campaign from the animal rights activists. It's a bit of a challenge if you're out there producing milk and meat to not get extremely frustrated by those claims because they're false.
Yeah, I know they're false, and I need to get more of that under my belt so I can just kind of whip it out and explain it the way I do other things related to nutrition and health. But as a dietitian, you know, I mean, some people have their specialties, but I mean, we really do need to understand the food piece better. So maybe you've already answered this. Like, what do you think the sticking points are that's leading to this confusion with people and the mistrust? Because there's lots of mistrust, as we've kind of established.
Well, there is, and there's a very specific report that I can point to. So let me first do that. Back in, I believe it was 2006, I'm trying to find the right section of food bullying because I actually covered this verbatim in here. The FAO released a report. So it was called Livestock's Long Shadow, and it had a great deal of international attention. The figures around animal agriculture's impact have been corrected since then by the report's senior author, but the damage has already been done. And so from my experience in researching and writing food bullying in my last book, it really comes down to the distrust. So if you're disconnected, and clearly in both of our countries, people are 3 to 4 generations removed from the farm. Only 1.5% of people in the U.S. and roughly the same in Canada are on farms, which leaves 98.5% of the population that's not. So that's a challenge. And with that disconnect, the disconnect starts the bullying cycle, which is followed by distrust, which is followed by fear, because clearly you're going to be scared of what you don't know, i.e. the future. What does the future hold with COVID-19? So that fear is then leveraged by bullies, and you are preyed upon by bullies who are looking for the fear. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. My head's just kind of spinning because...
Yeah, sorry. I was studying more statistics.
No, I don't mean in that way. I just mean I'm being made kind of like, not uncomfortable, but kind of just like being shaken a bit, which is a good thing. It's not a bad thing. And so that, I mean, I've seen a couple of presentations. One was this fantastic one by, I think it was out of Denmark, but it was a European man. Anyway, I'm not sure what his background was, but... He was kind of boiling it all down, and this number that you said that the impact has been revised, but the damage was done, is the estimated contributor to greenhouse gases by agricultural, all agriculture, animal and plant, about 8%?
All of agriculture accounts for 9% of greenhouse gases. Sorry, it's U.S. statistics, but that's what I had access to. And animal agriculture is only 3.9% of that 9% for all of agriculture. So keep in mind that agriculture is 9%, electrical production is 28%, industry is 9%. So I'm not sure why agriculture is unfairly targeted. I think because it's easy to point fingers at what you don't know. And most people, again, are disconnected from the farm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a huge problem. And I think that's really, it's something that has to be, like, can't be let up on in terms of just fighting the good fight. I'm confident, maybe. I'm not usually optimistic by nature, but I really think that there's sort of a bit of a breaking point. And I think people are going to hopefully wake up, but I'm not sure about that. But I, for some reason, I feel optimistic. I think people are kind of tired of being shamed and eating things by certain groups of people, which might segue great to the next point, the food bullying, name of the book, and how to avoid buying BS or bully speak. So it's a great topic for anyone. And so you've kind of talked about or described it. So what is food bullying and what is the bully speak that people are buying? Conceptually or examples, it doesn't matter.
So basically, when you look at the food system, here in the US, it's a $5.75 trillion business. $5.75 trillion with a T, to be clear. Mm-hmm. By my estimation, there's an average of 40,000 products in every grocery store, which means that you are sorting through around 200,000 claims when you go grocery shopping. I don't know about you, but I can't handle that amount of information. And so food bullying is really about how food has become a battleground, mostly because marketing tactics and misinformation that we've already talked about, people are feeling demonized around their eating choices. Parents are feeling guilty when they go and try to make the right food choices and nutrition choices for their children, and people are confused. And it seems as though people are feeling the need to tell each other how they need to eat. And in my opinion, no one should be offering food advice unless they're a registered dietitian nutritionist. And there certainly are RDNs that are bullies out there. And before anybody gets upset, there's also farmers that are bullies too. So I think, you know, food bullying goes from the labels to the activists to the mom groups that won't let you bring snacks if they don't have the right labels on them. It's a very broad reaching, overwhelming situation that we've gotten ourselves into where people, again, are feeling condemned around food rather than celebrating it.
I totally understand that because I'm guilty of that. And for whatever reason, I used to write a column in the Toronto Star in Toronto. I live in Toronto. And the theme of the column was, it was called The Vice Squad. I didn't come up with that title. But it was really trying to deconstruct a lot of the marketing around various products that I was trying to get, like when these outrageous claims about, you know, maybe cereal with X amount of A, B, C in it, with these real stretches around functional claims and that kind of stuff, and trying to, and that's a, really a form of the bullying that you're talking about, right?
Yes.
Like it happens at a subconscious level. It just gets kind of, because by default, you're thinking I'm either good or bad for choosing that stuff.
Well, exactly. But food shouldn't be about judgment. Food is a basic necessity. And one of the things that I cover in the book, for those of you that enjoy science and psychology, I actually use Maslow's hierarchy as a reference point on food buying needs. So we clearly all have very basic needs, which have been highlighted over the last several months, I might add. And those needs are physiological at the very bottom of the pyramid. That's things like being taken care of and having a house and so forth. And we have safety concerns. That's the next one. So when it comes to food buying, if we can get people back to thinking, is this food nutritious? Is this food safe? Then we stay away from the need for esteem and belonging, which is really where the bullies hit. And as you said, Doug, bullying is not always intentional. Some people are trying to do the very best they can for you. They're motivated by altruism, which is part of the belonging in the pyramid and Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and then also in the food buying needs. They want to help, but they come off as, well, this is the way I eat, so you have to eat this too, because this is the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, as a nutritionist, that is not necessarily the truth. So it's a real challenge, but I wouldn't be too hard on yourself. We're all bullies, myself included. Not always intentional, but there is a lot of bullying that happens out there.
Yeah, and I just, when I think about what's supposed to be counseling, which is really we do a lot of education or information exchange, when you're trying to steer people in one direction for a stated goal or benefit, and you start emphasizing the positives, I guess by default, there has to be a negative somewhere. Like it gets quite messy, but I know with myself, I got my own issues, which we won't get into around food bullying with myself and seeing food a little maybe too black and white. But I think what's scarier is just when you think about the number there, 5.75 trillion, you refer to it as a secret that food marketers and celebrity spokespeople don't want us to know, the unsuspecting public. I mean, you've talked about it. How are they hijacking our brains? You explained it, but I'm just wondering if you could maybe articulate it more specifically.
Sure. So one of the ways they're hijacking our brains is through confusion. Nobody can sort through 200,000 claims in a store. Even if it's a smaller store, you can't sort through 100,000 claims. And so the way that they are manipulating our brains are through some of these BS claims. And to be clear, BS is bull speak, not the other. So claims such as smart food, sustainable food, all natural food, these are claims that are not measurable. I'm sure as a dietitian, Doug, you love the detox and the superfood claims that are out there. And so you want to do the right thing for your family. You're buying food, whether you're at a restaurant or whether you're in the grocery store. You want to do the right thing. Food that's labeled as ethical or green or local sounds great. But I always go back, is there measure? Because if not, it's meaningless and it's BS. And is there definition? And if not, they're distinguishing the food from marketing. So if you cannot define what ethically raised food is, if there's not a certification with very specific parameters attached to that, and what I use as a reference point here in the US is FDA. And within the food bullying book, I actually went through about 500 pages of information, I think, and listed out the food claims that are actually measurable and therefore they're meaningful within the food bullying book. And those are in chapter 15 of food bullying. Certainly some commonalities within Canadian foods. You know, I might applaud you all because you at least don't have the non-GMO label up there, which is one of the biggest pieces of BS, in my opinion, that there is in the grocery store.
Yeah, no, we don't. And I don't want to speak out of turn, but I'm not sure if just because Canada is so, by nature, so conservative and safe, I think there might be more regulation around functional claims, et cetera. Not that that's necessarily resulting in less bullying, but yeah, they didn't opt for the GMO. And it's funny because I always thought, well, why not give people choice? Like why can't you just give them that information? But then as you say, it's just implicit that it's better and it's going to lead to confusion and all that kind of thing.
Well, right. And there's a dozen foods that have been bioengineered. And I applaud Canada for what you did because I remember watching it go down and the United States wasn't quite that smart. But in 2022, we are going to have a BE label, bioengineered, that everybody is required to use. And it will only be on the products that have been bioengineered, which is a very cool, precise technology that allows us to have food with benefits.
Is it like things like sugar beets and those kind of main things like corn? And is that different from the GMO? No, it's the same thing.
It's the same thing, but okay. Bioengineering is a better term because it's more precise. So as Dr. Kevin Folta at the University of Florida so aptly puts it, and he'd be a great guest for you too, he basically says, do you want your bridge to be modified or do you want your bridge to be engineered?
Right.
Well, the same is true in food. And so the precision of the technology is what's amazing. You know, hybridization. So whether that is how people have children or how corn has traditionally been bred, you know, you don't know what's going to happen with genes. It's kind of like a lottery. But bioengineering allows you great precision with the specific trait that you're working on. And so I love science. I happen to believe it's fascinating science because, again, genes are the coolest ingredients on our plate.
Yeah, it's interesting the disconnect that we have as human beings because if someone needs insulin, they have no problem using bacteria that's been genetically engineered. Yes. Bioengineered to produce insulin, right? Because yes. Then we put it in our bodies and people with diabetes who need insulin can live. And then we have these, I guess it's so emotionally driven. I'm not sure why it's different. It's all the same thing is what I'm getting at. It's no scarier or problematic in that regard.
It is. And I actually featured a Canadian sharing his experience with a daughter that was diagnosed as diabetic when she was 9. And he talked about the benefits that insulin from the GMO bacteria offered his daughter. So that's a pretty cool story that he offered up. Dale Leftwich is his name, if you know him. I believe he's over in Saskatchewan.
Okay. Yeah, people need context in that regard for sure. And I guess it's an easy hack or hijack because it's not dealing with the logical side of the brain, it's the emotional. So I think what COVID's taught me, or rather my opinion is, I think we're really driven by one dominant emotion, and it's fear. And I think that's allowed us to survive as a species. But I think this really, all these kind of BS messages kind of target that, which you've alluded to, or if not outright stated.
Yes, food bullying was actually motivated because I really felt like our brains were being messed with. And there's a fascinating new study by Dr. Tyler Davis out of Texas Tech that proved this. They actually use the fMRI, which is the frequency magnetic resonance imaging. It's basically where they take the pictures of the brain and they can, mm-hmm. you know, it lights up how your brain is processing information. And he differentiated between the two different parts of the prefrontal cortex, one being rational, one being emotional. And the food technology, the modern food technologies that the brain is the most fearful of, according to the study, is GMOs, antibiotics, and hormones. So that information, basically the brain sits there and spins in the rational part because it's afraid of it. It's operating from a point of fear, as you had said, Doug. But the technologies from the same study that were more emotionally accepted and therefore accepted by the person making the buying decision was sustainability and animal welfare. So it's really fascinating science. When you look at neuromarketing, it is very clear that marketers are trying to manipulate our brains, whether it's confirmation bias or whether it's the health halo effect that I'm sure you're very familiar with as a dietitian. I just wish that people would wake up and realize that their brains are truly being manipulated unless they choose to be able to operate from a rational standpoint and have that rational brain take over control from the emotional brain.
Yeah, and I don't know how we do that because I find this is some reactions. We keep talking about COVID, but some of the reactions around COVID, the rational part just seems to, I don't know if people are, it becomes too uncomfortable, but real growth and learning comes from being uncomfortable. You have to kind of face your biases. Or maybe we just go straight to the warm fuzzy stuff around sustainability and that type of thing and hijack the brain the other way or something.
Well, it certainly takes discipline.
Yeah. So this kind of interestingly segues to the last book, No More Food Fights. So this is a great theme, I think, to kind of consolidate everything that we've been talking about because it is so divided right now. It's ugly. It's messy. I get it as a practicing dietitian. I mean, I get it on social media. People will want to shame me for eating beef and eggs and that kind of thing. But then even when you're trying to work with people who may have been influenced by one way of thinking around food, you kind of, it's a soft fight, I guess, if you will, if I'm trying to kind of pull at people, trying to bring them to one area that's going to meet a goal. It's not me telling them how to eat, but if they want a particular goal, they might have to consider changing something. So what I'm getting at here is we'll never get ahead or we'll never move forward unless we find some kind of common ground or consensus. So what are some of the food fights that are going on right now? I think we all know about them. Or where's the battlefield? And is there hope, especially with social media and celebrities?
Well, that's a great question. So I actually wrote No More Food Fights. It released back in 2013. So it's now 7 years old, which is hard to believe. And a lot has changed since that time, but a great deal has stayed the same. So the book, as you alluded to, really focuses on the agriculture side of the plate and the six different ways to have a conversation with people that are at a different point on the plate, like a dietitian or a consumer. And then the other side focuses on the five senses plus common sense and having a food conversation, a civilized food conversation. And then at the center of the book is the common chapter about leadership and meeting at the center of the plate. And as you said, Doug, I'm not sure that we're making a lot of progress in that area. I have seen progress between the dietetic community and the agricultural community working together more closely. Over the course of my career, I do think that there has been a fairly dramatic improvement, that there are dietitians, and my hope is health professionals that are seeking more expertise and that firsthand knowledge of how food is raised. But as far as the battlefields, I mean, we touched on the major ones. Clearly, sustainability is one. Animal welfare, hormones and antibiotics and are another. Another, as a mom, that I see is that a lot of people bully themselves or are guilted by others around convenience. And my perspective is, if you have to stop at a fast food restaurant to feed your family, or you're throwing sandwiches around in the car as you head home from one sports practice, why do you have to feel guilty? You're feeding your family. You're doing what you can. So there's a lot of different battlegrounds, and those are certainly pretty nuanced. Again, I would love for people to be able to go back to the basics, get back to our very basic needs, and be able to ask the question, is this food nutritious and is this food safe? And if you can answer yes to both of those, you don't have to worry about anything.
So that's a great way to celebrate the truth in food. So the one, is it nutritious? That seems intuitive or obvious to me. What do you mean by safe?
Well, the safe food is something that we overlook in both of our countries because we expect the food to be safe. And when there are scares or different outbreaks, you know, when the produce has had an issue and there's E. coli or salmonella in different restaurants, it comes top of mind. Aside from that, Doug, when you go to the grocery store, do you ever really worry about whether your food is safe?
Never.
Exactly. Now, I will say that the empty store shelves and the increase in unemployment and the economic woes that COVID-19 has brought has also brought more awareness of food safety. But every statistic and report that I have ever found in my research points that across North America, our food supply is safer than it has ever been. We have amazing technology that allows us to detect problems earlier. So sometimes people get a little up in arms because they see more recalls and so forth, but that's actually a really positive sign that food safety is working.
Right, yeah.
So we just have to not take it for granted, I think.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if you meant, I was thinking another definition of safe, like if somebody has some, like same psychological perception around food. Is it safe for me to eat because it's going to not aggravate some kind of maybe mental health issue around eating? But that's why I just wanted to clarify it. So safe at the most basic level, food safety point of view, nutritious, it's graded. There's a bit of a continuum, but you have to think of it in terms of big picture, because as you say, if it's, you know, all you can do is get fast food and who knows if it includes some fries and a dessert, big picture is what's needed. And of course there is some nutritional value in there. It's not all necessarily bad. So that's really interesting. Okay. And so that's how you celebrate food. And so even though we've talked about this and there may be a lot of kind of a perception that maybe things are challenging and things are insurmountable, are you hopeful for a brighter tomorrow where all this is concerned?
Well, I sure am. I wouldn't be speaking and I wouldn't be writing books or working with folks to try to bring more understanding around food. And I think we all can have a brighter tomorrow if we can just get back to the basics and remember that we each should have our own health, ethical, environmental, and safety standards out there, our own principles, if you will, around food. And so my hope is that we can continue the conversation, and I would welcome any of you to join me on the Food Bullying Podcast if you're a podcast listener, which you probably are since you're listening to this, or you're welcome to connect with me on social media, and my handle is @mpainsafety. Speaker. So it's NPAYNSPEAKER, or at causematters.com. I always am delighted to connect with healthcare professionals, dietitians, others in the agriculture community, whether you're Canadian or elsewhere in the world. Just happy to have the conversation.
And you've got great resources for health professionals as well. So people who want to kind of up their knowledge of their expertise in this area, right? You have, I think, you have some things geared towards dietitians specifically.
I do. The Food Bullying podcast includes a lot of dietitians, and it is geared towards dietitians because we also have farmers and others, experts in the health arena. And then on the website, causematters.com, my books are all available there. You can order author signed copies, but I will be honest and tell you that shipping to Canada is a major issue. But they are available across all of the major bookstores. And then also at Cause Matters, if you go to the resources page, there's one specifically for food and dietetic communities. And within there, you will find a great deal of farm and advocate blogs from around the world, including Canada. And I would encourage you all to connect with organizations like Farm and Food Care and to be able to continue getting that perspective directly around how food is raised to make sure that you really have that firsthand expertise.
It's hugely important. So everything you said, I couldn't agree with more. I found this super interesting and I want to just thank you for your time and really direct people to your website because it's just so rich in content and resources. So again, thanks so much for being on, Michelle, and I hope you have a good day.
Well, thanks, Doug. Keep up the great work.
Thank you very much.
Hit subscribe and get ready to expand your nutritional world, your perspective, and gain confidence in a way that you didn't know you could. And be sure to check out my website, DougCookRD.com.